Revelation 12, 7 through 9 reads, "And there was a war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they did not prevail. And there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old who was called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him."
Well, it's good to see everybody here this morning. I know we have a few visitors with us today, and we're very honored by your presence. We certainly hope that if this is your very first time visiting with us, that you'll stick around a little while and give us a chance to get to know you. Please fill out a visitor's card so that we can reach out to you this week and thank you for your participation in our worship, and to find out if you have any spiritual needs. If you're curious about our congregation, if you'd like to learn more about the gospel of Jesus Christ and what that means, then we would love to sit down and talk to you about those things and open up our Bibles together. That invitation is always available here at East Shelby. Have your Bibles open to Mark chapter 5. We're going to take a look at a story from Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 20 here in just a few moments. It's a very interesting story, by the way, one that gets a lot of attention because there's some very odd things about this story. Some things stand out here in Mark chapter 5 as exceptional events in the ministry of Jesus Christ. We understand why it is, when you read the story, we understand why it is that the gospel writers included it in their narrative. So have your Bibles open to Mark chapter 5 in your New Testament, Mark 5, verses 1 through 20. Let's go ahead and read part of the story together, and then we'll make some comments along the way. Let's pick up in verse 1. "Now they came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. When he had come out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with chains. Because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, it says in verse 5, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gashing himself with stones. Now, seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, 'What do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me.'" And we'll stop there for a few moments. First of all, let's talk about the idea of demons. Demons always get a lot of attention this time of year. What with Halloween being yesterday, there's a lot of horror movies and scary TV shows, a lot of ghost stories that we hear, and demons continue to get a lot of curiosity from people. But it's that same curiosity that colors our understanding of them. And more often than not, it's man-made tradition or superstition that clouds the subject of demons. What's interesting, though, is for all the information that we see in culture and in literature and in movies and music, for all that attention that we give to the subject of demons, the Bible really doesn't have a lot to say about them, especially the questions that are most burning to us. Where do they come from? Were they fallen angels at some point? Does demon possession still happen today? The Bible does not give us a ton of information. But what the Bible does say about them is that it acknowledges that there is a great spiritual struggle. There's a war being fought over human souls. And it is those human souls that are the prize everybody wants. I think that's a good practical application for us to think about on the subject of demons. Even though demon possession, as we see it in the Gospels or in Acts, doesn't happen in the same way today, and I'll acknowledge that up front, I don't believe that demon possession happens in the same way that we see it here in like Mark chapter 5 and in other places. But there is a battle being fought for your soul. And Satan is trotting out all of his best devices. He's bringing out all of his best weapons. And so is God. I do think we forget about that sometimes on the subject like demon possession is. For as scary as this subject seems when we read it here in Mark 5, we need to remember that God has also brought out His best devices in our defense. There's a war being waged for your soul. And the casualty on God's side was His own Son. And that's very important to us. That's powerful for us. Well, are they fallen angels? A lot of people want to know, like, maybe they were fallen angels. And I think that's one likely understanding of it. That's one possible interpretation. We've already read from Revelation chapter 12 for our scripture reading. But go to 2 Peter chapter 2, as well as this other passage on the screen from Jude. Go to 2 Peter chapter 2, and notice just a little detail here in 2 Peter 2, verse 4. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, he goes on to talk about other things as well. But just that little idea there from 2 Peter 2, that there are angels that sin. There are angels that fall away from God's presence, and there is a punishment for those angels. Now, does that mean that's what demons are? Again, I'm not sure. That's one possibility. The same idea is reiterated a few pages later in your New Testament in Jude verse 6. Very similar idea here where it says, "And angels who did not keep their own domain but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day." Now these verses are not saying that every demon that you see in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John of the book of Acts, these verses are not saying that those demons are fallen angels. But these verses do provide maybe a little bit of insight about some of the things that are happening in the spiritual realm that we can't see with the naked eye. That there are angels that have fallen away from God. There are angels that have allied themselves with Satan. You see that as well in Matthew chapter 25, another reference that's not on the screen here. But in Matthew chapter 25, we find out about hell here in these verses. And it says in verse 41 of Matthew 25, "Then he will say to those on his left, 'Depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels.'" So the devil's not working by himself. The devil's got cronies. The devil's got people on his side. Not people necessarily. You know what I mean. I'm using accommodative language. The devil has allies. And they're angels, as they're so-called in those passages. Demons in the New Testament seem to manifest in a lot of different ways. Some brought superhuman strength to those that they possessed. Others bought prescient abilities, the ability to tell the future or tell someone's fortune. You see that later on in the book of Acts. They also controlled people's bodies and often led them to do things that were physically painful, as we see here in Mark chapter 5. It's not just that this guy in Mark 5 was given superhuman strength and he viewed that as a good thing. It was also that he was gashing himself and cutting himself. He was hurting his body. There are other examples from the New Testament where demons would throw the people they were possessing into the fire, or they were harming them physically. And so we see a lot of different manifestations. But is there demon possession today? Well, let's just be clear. This lesson is not about demon possession. It's about a man who was demon possessed in Mark 5. And we're going to get back to that story in just a moment. I have some speculation about this, by the way. And I'll just offer you what my insight is, what my opinion is on whether or not there's demon possession. Well, one thing that I notice, in cases of demon possession in the New Testament, there's a very high regard that those demons have for Jesus. Now, it's not that they want to obey Jesus. It's not that they want to be on the side of Jesus. They've clearly picked their side. They've chosen their side. And the side of tormentors, the side of tempters, the side of Satan, that's the side they've chosen. But when you see demons in the New Testament, they know who Jesus is, they acknowledge Jesus, and they respect the authority that He has. And you see that in James chapter 2, for example, where it mentions that demons do believe as well. Demons do believe. They know who Jesus is. And in all these cases, such as in Mark 5, the demons are always cowering before the power of Jesus. Please don't cast us into some kind of eternal pit of darkness. Or, you know, what do we have to do with you? You're Son of the Most High God. Show mercy to us. They cower before the power of Jesus. But you don't see that same thing. When you see demon possession portrayed in movies, for example, the demons are always defiling the objects of the Christian faith, crosses and that sort of thing. The demons scoff at authority. The demons are disrespectful. The demons are profane, especially when presented with objects of the Christian faith. And so I just don't think what you see in pop culture as far as demon possession goes, I just don't see how that can be the same thing that what we see in the New Testament. I also think there's an interesting reference in your Old Testament, and I know there's some speculation about whether this is talking about demon possession or not, but there's an interesting verse in Zechariah chapter 13 that I always kind of go to as maybe a hint at demon possession. But in Zechariah 13 and verse 1, in what is clearly a messianic theme, it says, "In that day a fountain will be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for impurity." Clearly, there's a messianic theme in this chapter. Verse 2, "And it will come about in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols from the land. They'll no longer be remembered. And I will also remove the prophets and the unclean spirits from the land." And so in what is clearly a messianic prophecy, there's this idea that I'm going to remove the unclean spirits from the land. Is that a reference to Jesus Christ removing demon possession? There's a lot of speculation one way or the other, but I'll let you study Zechariah 13 and see if you come to that same conclusion in that context. That's kind of enough on demon possession. I want to move on, and I want to look specifically at this story in Mark 5 because there's a lot of good practical application when we look at this story about this man who's demon possessed. Well, just for your reference, here's a little bit of the Sea of Galilee for you to consider. You know, what we've been reading, if you've been following along in Mark and in like a daily Bible reading, is up to this point is Jesus is kind of crisscrossing the Sea of Galilee. He is going to villages like Capernaum and Bethsaida. He's going around to a mostly Jewish audience on one side of the Sea of Galilee. And if you're not familiar with it, on a map of the Sea of Galilee, in the north and western side of the sea is primarily a Jewish population. And on the south and the eastern side of the sea is a primarily Gentile population. That region is sometimes called the Decapolis. It was 10 cities that were of a primarily Gentile population. So when he crosses over to the region of the Gerasenes or the Gadarenes, as other Gospels will call it, he's on a primarily Gentile side of the Sea of Galilee. And that's an important point that you need to keep in mind in Mark 5. It's a primarily Gentile side of the Sea of Galilee. It's interesting to see the way that demons will grant some pretty amazing abilities to the people that they possess. But I think one thing out of application that I want to point out is these abilities are never viewed by the demon-possessed as a good thing. Right? Nobody in the New Testament who's demon-possessed feels like they've got some advantage over anybody else. Like, life is not better when you've got a demon. So this guy in Mark 5, he's got superhuman strength. He can break chains and escape from bonds, and he has this like superhuman strength. But the man who's demon-possessed does not look back on that at the end of the story and go, well, ah, shucks, like, I guess I don't get to break chains and lift heavy objects anymore. He never viewed the demon possession as being advantageous to his life. And the same can be said in the book of Acts. There's a girl who has the ability to tell fortunes. She's demon-possessed. And yet she's enslaved to these swindlers. There's these hustlers who use her demon possession to their advantage and make a bunch of money telling people's fortunes. She never views that as, like, my life is really good right now. Like, you know, like, all things considered, I've got a demon, but hey, I can tell the future. Like, that's a pretty good living. She never viewed that as advantageous to her life. Having a demon with superhuman abilities is never better than not having a demon. It is never better than not having a demon. And I think we need to view some of our own dreams and aspirations through the same lens. I think we have all of these dreams, right? Whether it's money or beauty or fitness or career or what your image is or am I always going to look young and everyone's going to think I'm beautiful? We have these dreams and these aspirations that end up almost, that they cost us more in the end than they were ever worth. Those dreams keep us chained to a carnal path. And you could maybe talk about it like idolatry. Right? All of these things can become idols to us. We sometimes dream, especially when we're younger, of like what it would be like. What if you had $1 billion? Or what would it be like if, what would you do if you had $1 billion? Or if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you have? Or if you could, you know, if you could live anywhere in the world, where would you live? And we end up becoming chained to these dreams, these aspirations. They don't bring out the best in us. They certainly don't keep our minds focused on God. So here you have a man who has superhuman strength, something that a lot of us would dream of. Well, I don't know. If somebody like me, right, dreams of having superhuman strength. I actually just dream of having average human strength, quite frankly. But we look at a man with superhuman strength, but it comes with a cost. And I think there are people out there who would be envious of that. Like, well, I wish I had superhuman strength, even at a cost. I wish I had $1 billion, but what if it cost you your marriage? Okay, I think I'd take the $1 billion. Oh, I wish that I could live in Tahiti. Okay, but you'd be isolated from your loved ones. Well, I don't know. Tahiti sounds pretty nice to me. This is a guy who has superhuman strength. But there's a cost that comes with that. And I think our dreams sometimes are the same way. People with demon possession in the New Testament are always presented as suffering and lost and hopeless and shackled and abused and trapped. And all physical pursuits, to the detriment of spiritual pursuits, will do the same thing to us. You don't have to be demon-possessed to be chained and shackled to pain and suffering. You don't have to be demon-possessed to allow things of this world to drive you toward the tombs, to alienate you from the people that you love, to make you feel like you are lost and alone and broken and listless and pointless. You don't have to be this guy in Mark 5 to feel the same way that he does. Alienated. And so it says that he would cry out in his torment. Who was he crying out to? Have you ever been so sick that you just kind of like roll around in bed in a fever just saying, make it stop, make it stop? Have you ever been hurting so bad that you're just crying out to anybody? There's not a doctor in the room. There's nobody with a cure just standing right there. But have you ever been hurt so bad that you're just crying out for help? Has your heart ever been so broken? This story hurts to read, doesn't it? It's haunting. It's scary. This is a man who is in such deep despair and deep pain that he is out among the tombs, bones and graves. And he's just crying out in his incredible pain and suffering. Constantly, in verse 5, night and day, crying out and gashing himself with stones. And we can be the same way too. In a sense, we are legion, aren't we? We're like the man with legion. We have problems, and those problems can seem completely hopeless to us and complicated, and we feel outnumbered. It says in verse 8,
"Come out of the man, you unclean spirit," says Jesus the Most High. And he was asking him, "What is your name?" I've always wondered, by the way, at that point, and I don't know the answer, by the way. I've always wondered, was Jesus talking to the man and asking what his name was? Or was he talking to the spirit, the demon, asking what his name was? But it is the demon that answers out, "My name is Legion, for we are many." I don't know, that gives me chills every time I read. That's very haunting. "My name is Legion, for we are many." Now he began to entreat him earnestly not to send them out of the country. And we'll get to what happens here in just a moment. Now, I don't want to read into it too much here, but I see another application. There was more going on under the surface of this man's life. And people are complicated. I think our demons are very complicated as well. And I use the word demon very loosely there, by the way. What your demons are, the things that plague you, the things that dog you, the things that follow you in life. Our demons are very complicated. I think we need to give people credit for being complicated. And I think people can feel very outnumbered as well. I wonder what it must have felt like, by the way. And I have no idea exactly what it would have been like to have a legion of demons inside of me. But can you imagine the despair of being so outnumbered? If you're this man, and it's not one demon you're facing, not 10 demons, not 1,000, 6,000, 10,000 demons that you're facing that have all inhabited you, and they're ripping you from one side to the other and pushing you to do horrible things to yourself. I think we can feel the same way. Utterly outnumbered by our demons. Now, these demons didn't want to have anything to do with Jesus. Like I said earlier from James chapter 2, the demons know who Jesus is. There's no mistaking that. And similarly, we often push back when we're presented with the solution to our spiritual, moral, and emotional problems. When the answer is right in front of us, do we say, "What do we have to do with Jesus? What do we have to do with you, Son of the Most High God?" Yes, our problems are complicated, but they are not so complicated that God cannot help us answer them. Our problems are complicated, but they're not so complicated that Jesus doesn't provide an eternal solution to those problems. And so if we put ourselves into this story, I'm Ryan. I've got my demons. I've got the things that are tempting me. I've got the things that I'm ashamed of. I have various interests that pull me one way or the other, and many of them just pull me away from God, not toward Him. I am this man in Mark chapter 5, a complicated, hopeless, despairing man full of a legion of problems. And then somebody comes up to me and offers me Jesus. And I say, "What do I have to do with Jesus? What has Jesus got to do with anything? What does Jesus have to do with my financial problems? What does Jesus have to do with my marriage problems? What does Jesus have to do with my addiction? What does Jesus have to do with making my life better or making my life happier? What does Jesus have to do with any of this?" And when presented with the solution, our demons push back. "What do we have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High?" The answer is everything. Go to Romans chapter 8. And if you were in my Romans class this morning, we already studied this morning, so you get a double dose of Romans. Go to Romans chapter 8 and notice a few verses here in verse 5. Okay, Romans chapter 8, it says in verse 5, "For those who are according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who are according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For the mind set on the flesh is death, but the mindset on the Spirit is life and peace, because the mindset on the flesh is hostile toward God." It's hostile. What do we have to do with you, Jesus? It's hostile toward God, for it does not subject itself to the law of God, and it is not even able to do so. And those who are in the flesh, those who have their mind set on fleshly things, cannot please God. And when presented with the solution to our problems, we push back against the solution. You ever met somebody who is so stubborn that you're kind of looking over their shoulder and go, You know that you're turning that the wrong way, right?
No, I'm not. That's how it's supposed to be.
You realize that that final jigsaw puzzle piece goes in this way.
Dump it.
Do your kids ever do that?
I don't know where that move comes from.
But it's frustrating, isn't it? It's frustrating when you can present somebody with the solution to their problem and they go, stop it. You don't have to be demon-possessed to experience that same thing. I want to show you a couple of pictures of that side of the Sea of Galilee. The area of the Gerasenes, of the Gadarenes, again, as it's put in other Gospels. On one side of the Sea of Galilee, there are these incredible bluffs. And that picture is a little drowned out there because of the... I promise it looks really good on my computer. I promise. I blame you, projectors. But on one side of the Sea of Galilee there, in the land of the Gerasenes and the land of the Gadarenes, is these incredible bluffs, and very steep bluffs that go straight down into the Sea of Galilee. And you can imagine here, another picture from up on top, you can imagine that if you were a person or perhaps an animal like, say, a pig, maybe, that if you got a head of steam going down that hill, there's no way you're stopping at the bottom. So let's get back to Mark 5 and notice what ends up happening here. Let's see Act 2 of this story. So it says in verse 11, now, there was a big herd of swine feeding there on the mountain, and the demons entreated Jesus, saying, send us into the swine so that we may enter them. Now, it says in verse 13 that he gave them permission. A more exact translation might be, he suffered them to do this. All right, he suffered them. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. Now, in verse 14, their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country. And the people came to see what it was that had happened. And miraculously, in verse 15, they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed, sitting down, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion, and they all became frightened. That's a weird story, isn't it? I think most people, when they read this story, they kind of cock their head a little like, well, what just happened there? What just happened there? All right, I guess let's deal with this first of all. Property damage. I think sometimes people read this story and they go, so Jesus is just saying it's okay to take someone else's pigs and send him into the sea, huh? Well, let's be really clear about something here. Everything is God's. Right? So that's one answer, is everything is God's. Now, you can put a deed on it and call it yours. You can say that acre of land over there is mine. And I think God scoffs at that idea. Like, you know that the whole earth is mine. And the earth is my footstool. And I'm the God who spoke everything into existence and swirled galaxies out of nothing. So the idea that we could, like, push back on Jesus and say, hey, those weren't your sheep or your pigs to kill, everything is God's. Second of all, it's not like Jesus was the one who sent them into the sea. That was the demons in a fit of rage and despair, trying their very best to find some way to wiggle out of judgment from Jesus. I think based on what we read earlier from 2 Peter 2 and Jude verse 6, are any of those demons going to get away with it in the end? No. Because in the end, hell is for the devil and his angels. And all of those demons who thought they could, like, wiggle away from Jesus on some technicality, in the end, the judgment day is coming for them as well. So that's one way that you answer it. But I think there's another thing going on as well. Remember, we are in a primarily Gentile land. And so I think that there's something symbolic happening as well. What we see in this Gentile land is something that any Jew would have viewed as unclean. A herd of 2,000 pigs? Pigs were viewed as unclean animals according to the Jewish law. So I think there's something symbolic going on here in the way that Jesus takes an unclean spirit and he puts it into an unclean animal. That Jesus knows where to put unclean things. Trash belongs in the trash can. Garbage goes where garbage goes. Now, I'm not saying that God means that all pigs are inherently evil or anything like that.
because we know from Acts chapter 10 that there is a message there for them. That's a whole sermon on its own. But I think, again, in a symbolic sense, to a Jewish audience that might be reading this story, to any of his disciples who were there observing this happening before their eyes, Jesus takes trash and puts it in the trash can. The unclean belongs with the unclean. So I think there may be something very symbolic there. And the third point I would make is, look at the response of the people of this land. To them, a herd of pigs was more valuable than a human being in his right mind. A man's life has been changed. A man's life has been altered. A man's life has been made better by the power of Jesus Christ. And a miracle has occurred. And to them, they don't see the miracle. They don't see the salvation. They don't see the way a man's life has been changed for the better. They don't see Jesus in all this. What they see is a disruption of their routine and the destruction of a piece of property. And I think it's a commentary on them and their priorities as well. It says in verse 15 that they became frightened. In verse 16, those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine, and they began to entreat him to depart from their region. When confronted with the power of Jesus, they don't know how to process it. They don't know how to process it. And just like the governor Felix in the book of Acts, who told Paul the apostle, go away for now and I'll call on you on a more convenient day. A lot of times when people are presented with the gospel, they don't know how to process what they've just heard. And so instead of confronting it and all the truths contained in it, they push it away and they say, I'm scared of what you're saying. I'm scared of the power that you're displaying here. Just go away. I don't want to think about it. And unfortunately, we live in a culture, as has been the case throughout human history at different times, we live in a culture that prefers to be distracted, dumb, naive, and happy than to actually confront hard truths and the power of Jesus Christ. And so they entreat him, just take whatever bad juju you've got and leave our land. This is a little too frightening for us to confront right now. But then there's the man in his right mind. He begs Jesus. He entreats him in verse 18 that he might go with Jesus. What does he have left in his homeland? He's been alienated and isolated all these years. Nobody will ever know him except for being the man with the demon who lived among the tombs. That's his past. Jesus is his future. Take me with you, Jesus. But instead, Jesus says in verse 19, go home to your people. Report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everybody marveled. We all have been bound to something. We've been bound to our sins and bound to our guilt and bound to our regret. And Jesus comes along and he releases us from those chains. Yes, Legion could break physical chains. And there was nobody found who could bound him and hold him down. But Legion was the one with the chains. Spiritual chains. Coming to Christ and obeying him puts us into our right mind. Or as 2 Timothy 2:26 puts it, that they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil. So like the man in this story, our healing may mean a different kind of alienation. We're certainly not demon-possessed in the same way that he was. But it also provides an opportunity for us to go out and teach others about what great things the Lord has done for us and the mercy that has been given to us. So I know it's kind of a weird story, and it'd be easy to read this and just kind of breeze on passing. Well, that was strange. Yeah, it was kind of strange. But
People do strange things when they have done horrible things. People do strange things when they're bound by guilt. People do strange things when they allow their demons to run their lives. It's Jesus that makes things right. It's Jesus that puts us back to where we belong, in the state where we need to be and where we can be for all eternity, in His presence and His grace. If you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. Give your life over to Jesus Christ by heeding the gospel message, which is put so simply in Mark 16, verse 16. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So whatever spiritual need you have, let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.